From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 385 of Sunday House Call for this February the 19th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. Taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And before we get to the calls, if you remember, I think it was last week or the week before, I had asked the question and had a really good call from someone. I had a good discussion about this, about the smoking ban to outdoor places on patios and beaches and such. And the National Post, interestingly, just this Saturday, in a front page article written by Catherine Blaze Carlson, discussed this issue. And I read this with interest because it covers, I would say, with the discussion that I had with the gentleman who called, it covers both sides of the issues really well. But the person that was involved in this article, in terms of who they profiled, it was interesting to hear what he said. So I'm going to read the first few things about it, just so that you get an idea of, I don't think I'm coming out of left field out of this. So it starts off, Dr. Michael Siegel has been an anti-smoking advocate for 25 years, even testifying as an expert witness in a U.S. lawsuit that slapped the tobacco industry with a $145 billion verdict. He has stood before Congress and fought for smoking bans in restaurants, bars, and casinos, and he supports smoke-free playgrounds because they are designed specifically for children. Today, though, Dr. Siegel is breaking ranks with his own movement because he fears it has gone too far, jeopardizing itself from within by crusading for bans in even the largest of outdoor public places such as parks and beaches. By treading into the realm of Times Square or Stanley Park, as New York and Vancouver have done, the movement risks losing the science-based argument it has long won because, Dr. Siegel said, there is no evidence that fleeting secondhand exposure in an open space is significantly harmful. And he says, quote, once we leave the firm ground of science, we could be viewed as zealots, fanatics trying to eliminate smoking everywhere and everywhere, said Dr. Siegel, a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. The article goes on further to say this is not a health issue and it has nothing to do with helping to protect children, said British sociologist Frank Ferretti. There is a kind of crusading spirit behind this. It marks a slow process where people lose the critical capacity to say, this is enough. People become very scared to speak out because they will be accused of being complicit in endangering the lives of children. Many Canadians, it says here, many Canadians will also agree with Dr. Siegel that playgrounds should be smoke-free, that parents should not have to fear their toddlers chewing on a discarded butt in the sandbox. Outdoor bans are not a matter of science, they say, but a matter of preference in terms of everything else other than the playgrounds. So I bring this up again because it was front page. It is being brought up by somebody who crusaded and certainly follows up with the bans that we have in place. So it's not as if he's saying, I want to reverse things. It's that, are we going too far? Because if we are, and as I asked the question before, and as the caller that we had called up had some very good points, are we going too far because the science does not support this? Are we doing this more as a means of control as opposed to using science as a means of coming to that particular conclusion and enforcing that type of health issue? So I just thought I would bring it up because it was on the front page and it did certainly go along with the commentary that we had in a previous show. Now, the other thing I wanted to read out was, and I also would like to let you know that Dr. Yoni Friedhoff will be on the show with us next Sunday, and he'll be taking your calls about nutrition, diets, weight, obesity, diabetes, all the things that are associated with our health in the realm of food science and obesity, given that he is an expert in obesity. And so he wrote in his column today, And the show will also start at 4:30 next week, just so that everybody is aware. Likely we have another hockey game, so we'll be going from 4:30 till 6. But what I'd like to read out is his blog, which I thought was very interesting, because this goes to the root of pseudoscience. And the difficulty, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, this is just one show, an hour on a Sunday, and frankly, very low budget. And we don't have the resources that big-time television health shows have. And so the difficulty that we face is that these shows can promote all kinds of weird things, all kinds of pseudosciencey stuff, and it becomes very difficult to counter that type of promotion when it is reaching millions of people concurrently, as opposed to a small radio show that really, you know, is in this just this particular area. And so I wanted to read this because it does go to the difficulties that we face and I face as a physician when people come in and talk about this. So Dr. Feedhoff starts off, first, Dr. Oz, the doctor who during his interview with McLean's scientists, Julia Belews, commented on the benefits of raspberry ketones for weight loss by stating, quote, the amount of weight you'll lose is 2, 3, 4 pounds or more than you would have. He also quantifies a statement with a could be. And how about Dr. Oz, the television personality? The episode on raspberry ketones was literally entitled Miracle Fat Burner in a Bottle. Dr. Oz, the television personality, described them as amazing, said, I never understood how powerful it could be until I started doing research, and that he's a big fan of these things. And then to demonstrate how they supposedly worked in the body, took red balloons that he called fat cells and put them into liquid nitrogen, where they promptly deflated. To help make his case, he brings on Lisa Lin, a trainer who, yep, you guessed it, sells raspberry ketone supplements for $791.76 for a year's supply. And near the end of the segment, he asks her, I want to be practical. I don't want to overpromise. How long will it take to see a benefit? Her unchallenged answer, 5 days. They then go through some exceedingly dramatic before and after photos, without commentary as to what changes aside from taking raspberry ketones the subjects had undertaken, and with the second subject a frank discussion that overtly suggested that it was just the raspberry ketones that had done the trick. His conclusions? Quote, I think this is worth experimenting with, and that, quote, they're going to help your body think it's thin. The science behind raspberry ketones, if you want to call it that, are two shaky mouse studies. But even if we were to take them to be fully translatable into humans, a gigantic and unwarranted if, but I'll be generous, let's go back to Dr. Oz, the doctor, who points out that we're talking a 3 pound, I split the difference, total loss of consequent to their ingestion. The miracle here isn't raspberry ketones. The miracle here, and it's not a pretty one, is that a doctor is recommending his patients, because his viewers see him as a purveyor of expertly vetted medical advice, spend $791.76 a year for a remotely plausible but admittedly not conclusively attainable 3 pound weight loss, and that he's describing that 3 pound weight loss as powerful, amazing, and a miracle. Though I guess it's not exactly a miracle, it's just fame and fortune, powerful, powerful drugs, which seem in Dr. Oz's case to allow for some interesting rationalizations. And hey, want a super secret miraculous way to lose 3 pounds without spending hundreds of dollars on questionable supplements? Try a 3-minute walk a day. A year later, those same 3 pounds will be gone. Taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call, hopefully the bastion of evidence-based medicine in a very lonely world. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. Long distance, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And we're going to go to line one and welcome Leo in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think it's a two-part question.
Sure.
Would a very, very high level of ferritin cause tremor?
High levels of ferritin usually would give you, depending on how long you've had high levels of ferritin.
I'm at 1,975.
Yeah, and have you been diagnosed with hemochromatosis?
Or, yes, yeah. Exactly.
And are they treating you for that?
Well, what happened, I was seeing a doctor, and then we had a bad experience, so I ended up getting another doctor, and my first appointment will be at the end of the month.
Okay. With regards to what it does to you, mainly it, the iron deposits in tissues, right? So it will deposit into the liver, into the heart, the pancreas, can cause damage that way. I haven't, and I'm looking it up right now with regards to the symptoms of hemochromatosis and the main ones, and there's no mention per se of tremors that result from the hemochromatosis. There certainly are other things that can happen, but nothing that mentions tremors per se.
Because my blood cells are supposedly, the red blood cells, 2.5 times the normal.
Right. Well, what happens with excess iron? You have a lot of iron deposition.
Right.
You can potentially have more red blood cells in your bloodstream just because of the excess iron.
Oh, okay.
But that in itself shouldn't cause tremors.
Oh, okay. So what is the main cause of tremor then?
Well, what I would have to ask you in the follow-up questions are,
sure,
is it the hands or the feet?
Hands.
Okay. And is it worse when you're holding on to things? If, say, you're trying to draw or write, does the tremor get worse?
Well, sometimes it does, but I notice if I get too much anxiety, then I begin to have tremors.
Okay, because one of the more common forms of tremors is something called an intention tremor.
Right.
An intention tremor is not a neurological disease per se. It's a, if you think of a muscle, if we just sort of make a mental picture of this, say you have a muscle that is attached on both sides. So there's a string on both sides of the muscle and it's attached to the bone. Okay. Just have that image. And on top of that muscle sits a coiled spring that has on each end of the spring is stuck into each end of the muscle. So it's literally measuring when the muscle stretches, the spring stretches, and is a way of measuring how long that muscle gets stretched. That spring has a nerve attached to it, and it senses and tells the nerve when the muscle gets stretched too much. Hey, you know, the muscle is getting stretched too much, and it's in danger of getting torn or damaged. So I'm going to tell this nerve to send a signal to the muscle to tell the muscle, you know what, it's time for you to contract and get shorter again so that you don't get torn. And so that kind of feedback is what can lead to a tremor, in that you get this loop that sets up. The muscle ends up stretching a little bit, and the spring, which is the sensor, is sending information back and saying, okay, contract down. But then the muscle still thinks it's stretched, and it goes back and forth and back and forth, and you get this type of tremor. And so an intention tremor is when you start to do something, when you start to try to, for example, hold a pen and start to draw or start to write, you need even more control over the fine muscles of your that run into your hand, or the fine muscles of your arm that control your hand. And when you do that, that type of accuracy and that type of fine movement only exacerbates that whole circuit and makes it shake even more.
Is that part of the nervous system?
That is part of what we call a neuromuscular or muscle spindle type of arrangement. It's not nerve damage. It's simply that the feedback loop, the protective mechanism that is designed to prevent your muscles from getting torn, is overreacting, and it's causing the muscles to twitch. And when they twitch, you get that tremor. And so there is a way to treat something like that. In fact, it's very, very easy to treat if it is intention tremor. And certainly anxiety can make that worse, because with anxiety, nerves get stimulated. The nerve gets stimulated. The muscles can spasm a bit more. They can contract a bit more. And that whole loop gets affected even further. And the way to treat that if it is intention tremor, is to use a small dose of something called propranolol, which is a beta blocker. And what it does is it dampens that nerve signal within the muscle. So you don't get that feedback anymore. The muscle settles down, the twitches slow down, and the tremor tends to, if not completely go away, certainly become much more dampened and much less of a problem.
So when I see my doctor at the end of the month,
yes,
I should ask for a beta blocker?
You should first ask them to examine the tremor.
Oh, okay.
And there's some very straightforward tests that can be done just in the office to
right.
check tremors.
Mm-hmm.
A good way, again, of knowing whether this is an intention tremor or not is usually if someone takes hold of your hands and holds them, the tremor will usually stop. Or when you're holding a pen and he or she will give you a pen to hold and trying to write your name, if your hand is shaking a lot when you're trying to write, but when you drop the pen, the hand stops shaking as much. That also is a clue that this is an intention tremor. And then the beta blocker, it's a very low dose. Usually it's anywhere between 10 to 30 milligrams a day, and usually as needed. You don't have to take it all the time. If you're not bothered certain days by the tremor, you don't have to bother taking it because it works relatively quickly. And the original use of propranolol a long time ago, this medication has been around for 40 or 50 years, was to treat high blood pressure. But to treat high blood pressure, the dose usually has to be around 150 to 200 milligrams. You're only going to be taking 10 milligrams or so, between 10 and 30 milligrams. So it's going to have a negligible effect on blood pressure, but certainly have a very good effect on the tremors. And what's interesting about this, because you mentioned anxiety, it's used by people who have stage fright because it tends to slow down heart rate, reduce sweating. All the symptoms that you usually associate with anxiety where everything is activated, it tends to dampen those because a lot of times when people get stage fright, it's the fact that their heart starts beating and they start sweating and it makes them feel even more nervous. But by blocking the actual physical sensation, they tend to be calmer because the cues that normally would trigger their anxiety even further have disappeared.
Okay. Would the panic attack worsen the situation?
Panic attacks certainly could. Panic attacks, though, is a diagnosis. So there's panic attacks usually because of panic disorder, and there is a specific and different treatment for that, but there are specific criteria to diagnose anxiety disorders or panic disorders. The major difference being when we compare what we call a generalized anxiety disorder versus a panic disorder is that in generalized anxiety, people usually are not waking up at night feeling terrified, feeling like they're going to die, that they can't breathe, that they're sweating a lot, that their heart is racing, and they're just sort of bounding out of bed like that or waking up and with a start. That tends to be seen in panic disorder. You don't tend to see that in anxiety, generalized anxiety disorders. With generalized anxiety disorders, it's a general nervousness or anxiety that somebody has throughout the day, excessive worrying, small things that usually wouldn't bother somebody now tend to become more of an issue. Conflicts with people become major problems. The reaction that people have to conflict or stress is much more magnified or amplified. They have difficulty functioning at work, focusing and concentrating. Falling asleep at night could be difficult. Racing thoughts as well, where they can't slow their mind down. They're thinking about things all the time. Those are what you tend to see in anxiety-related disorders, but it is a very specific diagnosis and does require a good interview with either the family doctor or with a psychiatrist to be able to come up with something, if there is something in that vein, to have a good treatment for it.
Well, thank you, Connie. I appreciate it very much.
You're very welcome, Leo. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a small break. And when we come back, break for the news. When we come back, we have Christine and Greeley, who would like to talk about Olmatec and Trazodone. And Patricia in Ottawa would like to discuss rheumatism. The rest of our lines are available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Looking forward to your calls in the next half hour, and we'll be back in a few minutes after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. ABC. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And going right back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Christine in Greeley.
Hi.
Hi.
Excuse the beeping on the line. Someone's trying to get through.
That's okay.
I'm taking Olmtec. My doctor switched over from Diavan to Olmtec for high blood pressure.
Okay.
And I've been taking Trazodone for several years for sleep.
Okay.
And I have found the nest, since I've started the Olmtec, I haven't been able to get any sleep. Could one have anything to do with the other?
Well, I actually looked this up for you to see if there's any drug interactions at all. And this is from UpToDate.com, and they have a really good database that will find anything and everything with regards to any interactions.
Yes.
And with these two medications, they find absolutely nothing between the two.
So it's all me.
Well, no. What you may want to look at, and this is something that I encounter a lot, is that with medications, sometimes, especially with generic medications, you can be on, for example, Trazodone comes as generic, and that you can go from one batch to another batch, and it may not work as well. Even though it's the same medication, you may find it changes from Apotrazodone to PMS Trazodone or Teva Trazodone, just different companies.
Yeah,
so there's, and even within the same company, when they get their batches from China or India, where most of this is made, it's not always coming from the same factory or manufacturing plant. And so you may find differences where Trazodone is given usually to help someone sleep at night.
Yeah.
And so if there's been a sudden change where you haven't been able to fall asleep and nothing really else has really happened in your life to really make it difficult to sleep, I would check to see, you know, for example, was the Trazodone just renewed? Did you have, or is this the same?
No, it's almost down to the end from 500 tablets.
Okay.
I'm wondering if it's just nerves.
Well,
I'm expecting not to sleep, therefore I don't.
That can do it too. Now, when you're trying to sleep, are you sort of staying in bed for until you fall asleep, or are you getting out of bed?
No, I stay in bed.
Okay. Let me introduce you to the 15-minute rule.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah. I do.
And you have to do the 15. This is what all the sleep centers will recommend first. Because by staying in bed, what happens is that you are literally training yourself to know that when you, and you said it yourself, when you go to bed, you're not going to fall asleep.
Yeah.
And so you have to break that whole training of what happened to your brain and remap it. And what the 15-minute rule does is it literally, over 2 weeks, will physically change the structure of an area of the brain called the reticular formation, which is responsible for your sleep cycle.
Wow.
And by forcing it, because when you think about it, our brains are... We call brains, in terms of what they can do, plastic, or we call neuroplasticity. The brain will change. Our brains don't stay static. The nerve connections that are in there will change. Good examples, for example, somebody that is learning to figure skate. And the more they practice, the more proficient they get. As with any skill, the more you do something, the better you get. But you have to ask the question, why do we get better the more you do it? It's because you're literally burning in pathways of the brain that gets used over and over and over again, and you're strengthening that pathway. Well, for the same reason with regards to sleeping, it's a skill. And as strange as it may sound, it becomes a skill to be able to fall asleep when someone is having difficulty sleeping.
Even when you take the Trazodone.
That's right.
Yes.
And so what you have to do is you literally have to train your body, in this case training the brain, to respond to the cues that will lead you to sleep. And the only way to do that is by, well, one of the ways, but the first way to do that is the 15-minute rule, where you only allow yourself 15 minutes in bed. If you can't fall asleep, you have to get out of bed. You have to do something that makes you tired. You go back to bed. 15 minutes, not asleep, back out of bed, and you do that over and over and over again. And it's difficult to do. It's, you know, it's a very simple rule in terms of what it is, very difficult to implement because people get fed up. because they do this for a day. They don't fall asleep all night. They have to, and you have to stay up the whole day the next day. You can't take any naps. You have to go to bed at the same time every night. You have to wake up at the same time in the morning. So if you haven't fallen asleep until 5 a.m. and you have to get up at 7, you have to get up at 7. And you do that for 2 weeks. And usually after the first week or even by the second week, most people will have established a normal sleep routine. And it's also a good way to get out of the use of medications for sleep, because the brain is designed to fall asleep at specific times, but it's when we get off track, when there are things that happen in our lives that disrupt our ability to fall asleep, certain concerns or anxieties, and we start thinking a lot at night, makes it more difficult to fall asleep. And then we end up sleeping in, or we end up disrupting our sleep cycle, literally creating a type of jet lag situation. And as a result, we end up disrupted and we depend on medications to fall asleep. But the medications are really more of a short-term solution. Ultimately, my view is that if we can get people off medications and just have them sleep normally, obviously that's going to be a better thing to do. But it is and does take a lot of effort to do it. I'm by no means suggesting it's a simple thing. Oh, go ahead, do the 15-minute rule. It really takes a lot of effort. Usually, I recommend people do this when they have time off or if they have a vacation coming up or something where, you know, if they have to go to work or they have other responsibilities, it can be a very difficult thing to try and implement at that time.
Yes. That's very helpful. I really do appreciate that knowledge.
You're very welcome, Christine.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Now. And over to line 3, and good afternoon to Patricia in Ottawa.
Oh, hi, doctor.
Hi.
I phoned you about 3 weeks ago. I was having terrible pains in the muscles of my arm and
yes.
my shoulder, and you thought it could be PMR.
Yes.
I went to my doctor, and he was thinking along the same lines. He gave me a blood test then and there, phoned me the next day and said it was not that.
Okay.
So he asked me, would I take prednisone, a high dose, for 5 days? Which I agreed to.
Okay.
And I was fine. That was 2 weeks ago. I am nearly back to square one.
So when you took the prednisone, it did help you?
Yes, it did.
So there is an inflammatory process that's going on in those arms.
Yeah.
What I would recommend then is, again, if you're taking prednisone and the symptoms went away after a day or two, like full arm function, it still does not mean... Even though that blood test may have been negative, you still may have something that is causing damage to those muscles, because prednisone is an anti-inflammatory medication. And if it helped regain the muscle function, the pain went away and you had good function, you could lift your arms and you felt like you had...
I was on a very high dose, doctor. I was on 50 milligrams just for 5 days.
Yeah, and that's...
Just to try.
Sure. Well, what the next step would be is a referral to a rheumatologist.
Yeah.
Where they can do even more specialized tests to evaluate the arms, because it is, if you're back to square one, it tells us that the mechanism that is leading to this pain in your arms is certainly an inflammatory condition, and prednisone having helped it is a major clue that something indeed is going on, that this is not just a simple matter of sore arms. This is something that likely is more of a chronic disease nature and should be evaluated in full. So definitely have a rheumatologist see you. It's important, though, as much as the prednisone was helpful, when you see the rheumatologist and you have blood tests done, it's important to be off the prednisone, which you are, because it otherwise will mask the ability to detect things. Right.
Yeah.
But it's still, I would say, Patricia, you still have some, I think you still have some rheumatologic condition that is contributing to this. The prednisone certainly gave us a clue that something is up, but you do need a more definitive diagnosis.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, doctor.
You're very welcome,
Thank
Patricia.
You.
Bye-bye now. And we still have some time before the break, so we'll go to Diane in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Diane, are you there?
Yeah, sorry.
Hi.
I couldn't hear you.
Oh, that's okay.
Sorry. I'm just curious, and I know it's probably a really dumb question, but why do we need to keep our breath or whatever oxygen level between 92 and 93 for the body? What happens if we don't?
Well, that's not a silly question at all, Diane. And the reason is the fancy answer, and you can, you know, you can even say this to people and people look at you going, wow, how does she know that? You can call this the oxygen desaturation curve that we have.
Okay.
What that means is that the way your red blood cells and your hemoglobin release oxygen is dependent upon how much it is saturated. That is, how much oxygen is actually being carried. And although 88% sounds like a lot, when the oxygen saturation is at 88%, your red blood cells are not able to deliver that oxygen to the tissues very effectively. The oxygen doesn't come off that red blood cell as easily as it does when it's at 92 or 93%. And so that's why at 88%, it's considered to be really abnormal. You can't really live very well with an oxygen saturation of
88%. What does it do? What does it affect?
Well, what it affects is that it means that for every breath that you are taking, you cannot deliver oxygen to your heart properly. So it increases your risk of heart attack because your heart muscle can't get the oxygen. You can feel very tired, short of breath, fatigued, everything, because your body depends on oxygen. So you're just not getting enough oxygen. You can't walk any distance. You find that when you start to exert yourself, you don't have that same endurance because your body can't deliver the oxygen effectively or efficiently. And that's why people who have oxygen saturations that are below 92% on an ongoing basis usually have to carry oxygen with them in order to bring it up to that level so that it can be distributed properly throughout the body.
Yeah, that's what's happening.
Yeah.
When you're at a relaxed state,
mm-hmm.
and let's say 88, 89, it's still not good if you're at a relaxed state?
No. In fact, that even means it's worse, because what happens is that we look at what happens when someone actually has to move and get up, because you're not going to be sitting all day.
Right.
The minute you get up and start moving around, your body takes even more oxygen out of that, and that level can drop down from now 89% down to 85, 84, and you can faint. You just can't. There's not enough oxygen going around, and you can actually collapse from that.
Okay, because I've gone down to 83.
That's pretty low.
Yeah, and
that's
really low.
Yeah,
because my mask fell off while I was sleeping.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering, because I didn't feel faint, I didn't feel weird, I didn't feel nothing.
The minute your body does adapt slowly when that happens, but the minute you would get up and try and walk around or do something, you would desaturate even more, and that's where that problem could arise. It's just not a great idea to have those low oxygen levels, Diane.
Okay, so it's affecting the heart then.
It can affect heart, lungs, everything. Muscles,
okay, thank you.
Everything. You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. We're going to take a small break. When we come back, Christine in Ottawa would like to discuss Baker's cyst, and Kay in Rockland would like to talk about apalpantoprazole. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back after this short news break.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Check it and see, I got a fever of 103. Come on, baby, do you do more than dance? I'm hot-blooded.
Yeah, and back to the phone lines. Just before we go back to the phone lines, I made a small error with the word that I used when I talked about that oxygen curve. It's called the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, not desaturation curve. I got my words tongue-tied. And again, it's an S-shaped curve. Think of the letter S and how you would draw the letter S from top to bottom. At the top of the letter S, it tends to be flatter. That's when you have the most saturated, what we call, you know, the 92 to 95% saturation. And as you move down and draw that letter S, as you go down that curve and it starts to slope down steeply, that's when the saturation starts to go down. And for any given pressure where you are, we call the partial pressure of oxygen, which is what we have in our bloodstream where we are. For every given pressure, if the saturation goes down and someone is breathing at 88%, you cannot get oxygen out of those red blood cells. It drops off too quickly, and you end up literally being starved for oxygen. So that's sort of what that curve is all about. So we're going to go speak to Christine in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
Well, I'm kind of curious.
Sure.
I have a Baker's cyst in my leg,
mm-hmm.
and it's 4.1 centimeters.
Right.
What do they do for a Baker's cyst?
Usually, the treatment for a Baker's cyst is to treat the underlying condition that causes Baker's cyst. The most common cause of Baker's cysts is osteoarthritis. So arthritis in the knee, inflammation of the knee, can cause fluid to accumulate, and this cyst can appear. Sometimes they will drain the cyst. That is, they'll try to take some fluid out if the knee is having difficulty, you know, having difficulty moving the knee. But usually they won't drain it, because if the underlying condition is inflammation from arthritis, that arthritis is not going to go away. And as a result, it'll just fill up with fluid again, and the whole process will start again. So ultimately, it's using things to reduce inflammation in the knee, to use the leg if possible, and to try to stay mobile. The danger of a Baker's cyst is more one of discomfort. That is, if it gets too large, it sometimes can rupture. And when it ruptures, the fluid that is in that cyst will sort of run down the inside of the leg to the calf muscle, and it can be quite painful when that happens. It doesn't cause any permanent damage. It's more just very painful. But again, the cause of a Baker's cyst is that the knee joint itself is usually inflamed from arthritis.
Okay. Mine is down more at the muscle of the leg,
mm-hmm.
and it's 4.1 centimeters, and I just don't know anything about it, and I was concerned because I figure if it gets too large, it will break. And how do you know, or when do you know it has broken?
Usually you'll know that it breaks when there's a sudden pain in that area, unfortunately. That's how you would know that the cyst has ruptured. It is in that area of the muscle, because where that muscle attaches, your gastrocnemius muscle and the soleus muscle, which is what are the main muscles of your calf, they'll attach in the back of the knee. That area in the back of the knee, the fancy term for it is called the popliteal fossa. Fossa simply means a little hole or area or space. And popliteal refers to the knee. And so the cyst will sit in that area where the muscle will attach. If it doesn't, as I said, if it doesn't interfere with your ability to bend the knee and walk, they usually will leave that alone. And again, the reason being is that putting a needle in there, you don't want to potentially introduce any infection into a leg. Even though you're using sterile technique, it's still, if you can avoid sticking needles into people, you avoid sticking needles into people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you drain that fluid, it's basically a little balloon that's in there. And so all that's going to, it's connected to your knee joint. So all that's going to happen is, because there's inflammation in the knee itself, it's going to fill up with fluid again. So you don't want to keep going every few weeks to get fluid taken out of that area. It's just not a good thing to do. Ultimately, the treatment is usually anti-inflammatory medications to reduce the inflammatory process, to reduce the fluid that accumulates in there.
I can't take anti-inflammatory.
You have problems with your stomach?
Well, I would say, because they told me at one point my stomach would either bleed
right.
or it would affect
okay.
the heart.
Yeah.
So
the other thing that you might be able to try, at least for the knee itself, is you can buy topical anti-inflammatories, which won't cause the same problem with your stomach. There is something called Voltaren Emol Gel that they sell in the pharmacies that will help for pain in the knee. If the knee is painful, it can be used on arthritic joints. It's certainly not the best way in terms of alleviating pain, but given that you have that reaction, it's certainly something that I would say is worth trying. It's not expensive to buy over the counter. And as I said, it's called Voltaren Emol Gel. And it might be helpful at least to alleviate some knee pain if you're having knee pain. Whether it'll help with the cyst, not entirely sure if that's going to do much for the cyst, though.
I'm using cold packs and
mm-hmm.
then 15 minutes and then to the warm packs.
I probably wouldn't use heat on that. Heat on a joint that's inflamed is actually going to make it more swollen. The cold is actually perfect. If you can use ice packs after you walk, ice packs after activity for about 15, 20 minutes, that's the perfect thing to do. But heat will actually encourage more fluid and more inflammation in the area. Heat is good for a muscle, because when a muscle gets torn, heat is actually helpful. It brings in blood. It helps the muscle heal. But for a joint which really has no muscle tissue in it, it'll actually cause more fluid to accumulate within the joint.
Well, that's very good to know. And I thank you very much for your time and have a pleasant day.
Thank you. You too, Christine. And very quickly, we have about a minute and a half left. Kay in Rockland.
Right. Okay, I'll make it fast.
Sure.
No, I had a gastroscopy.
Yes.
And they checked the esophagus, of course, and they found that I had scarred tissue there.
Yes.
And he widened the esophagus. Now, he's recommended this medication, but I've heard different... Is that apple, what do you call apple?
Pantoprazole, yes.
Pantoprazole, yeah. I've heard people saying that you can get like more acid and that sometimes it can affect your organs. And I'm hearing all sorts of things that it's better to go on a good diet.
No, you've already had damage to the esophagus, which means you had acid that went up into the esophagus and damaged it and scarred it. Pantoprazole blocks acid production in the stomach, so it'll reduce the reflux that's going on and protect the esophagus. The danger of acid continually stimulating the esophagus is that over many years, and many years meaning 10 years or more, unopposed acid damage to the esophagus can lead at times to scarring and also esophageal cancer.
Okay.
So, it doesn't affect other organs per se. We only have about 10 seconds left.
Yeah,
but
okay.
The main thing is it certainly is recommended for that situation.
Okay, do the scars ever go away? Or
they're widened, but the damage is there. That's why you want to prevent any further damage.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Dorkin.
You're very welcome, Kay. Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
And thanks to everyone and your calls this week. Thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call. And Dr. Yoni Friedhoff will be with us next Sunday at 4:30. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.